Hello, I'm Greg, and welcome to a talk back episode for Walk the Earth number 49. Walk the Earth 49 was originally released in January of 2018. And I originally thought going into this year that the time of talk back episodes had come and gone. So let me begin this with a quick sort of state of the station. Because of some changes in my work-life balance, I've spent the last 6 months posting mainly shorter episodes of poetry and prose, almost all of it mine, one extensive Bible quote notwithstanding, and a Christmastime callback to a now pod-faded podcast that I used to enjoy right around the time that Inappropriate Conversations and Walk the Earth were getting started. I thought the era of talkback episodes was over, though, because I have since gone to Spotify, and on Spotify, among other podcatchers, have provided every episode to podcatcher apps. I say, and probably say in the course of this episode that I'm repeating, that everything I've ever recorded is still available at inappropriateconversations.org, and that is true. The right navigation that used to provide the ability to find things by month is no longer functioning. At some point, I may have to rethink the website entirely in terms of its structure and design. But just because it's not as easy to search things there as it used to be doesn't mean that the episodes aren't there. It's just true that the easiest way to search older episodes now is via podcatchers, including Spotify. Having said that, one reason I had for doing talkback episodes over the past, say, 3 years was to bring old episodes back when I didn't have them shareable to, you know, again, Spotify and other places. But the other reason was to respond and update past episodes based on new information, or even in this case, new current events. I am, of course, extremely disappointed that an episode that goes back to 2018 is still this relevant today. But the first thing I thought when I heard news coming out of the state of Alabama in calendar year 2024 was, we've already covered that, I believe, on Walk the Earth. And we have. Quoting from a news article from NPR, how fetal personhood and Alabama's IVF ruling evolved from the fringe to the mainstream, March 24th, 2014. The lead is, the Alabama Supreme Court's decision that frozen embryos have the same rights as children came as a surprise, even to many who oppose abortion rights. But for researchers and activists who have long tracked narratives at the most extreme end of the anti-abortion movement, this legal determination was inevitable. The reason this ties back to a previous Walk the Earth was that, unlike Inappropriate Conversations, which focuses as much on politics as it does religion or pop culture, Walk the Earth tends to be a religiously focused show. It was started as a podcast to document my family's journey from not just one church to another, but one denomination to another, as we began to find things that weren't working, even within a Protestant movement that was a denomination that was a Protestant movement of another Protestant movement of the Catholic Church. So three generations of protest against, and corruption seems like too strong of a word, but problems within those denominations led me to even leave that denomination in pursuit of something that was more Christ-following than just using Christianity as branding label. And so in the midst of trying to make that transition, raised a lot of questions, even really basic ones like, you know, what is the church? What's a sermon? That sort of thing. And if you were to go back and seek out the Walk the Earth episodes, that podcast, you know, all the ones beginning with the words Walk the Earth, it sort of details how that set of questions defined our journey from one church to another. And even upon finding a new church home, some of the questions that were still lingering and being raised there. This one was less about something that was related to changing churches and more about truly responding to current events of the day. Unfortunately, those events have become current again, as essentially the Alabama Supreme Court has ruled that all frozen embryos are children. It's an extension of this notion within the anti-abortion movement that life begins at conception. So my way of encouraging people to revisit Walk the Earth number 49 is that I do talk from a scriptural perspective, from a religious perspective, about what's missing, what's fundamentally wrong and naive in that view that, you know, life begins at conception is somehow a Christian concept. It is certainly not a Jewish concept, and therefore, from an Old Testament perspective, it's not a Christian concept either. And I explain how we got to the place we're in today from the perspective of biblical translation and biblical interpretation and where that all went wrong. But why I wanted to record an introduction to some degree was to sort of hammer home a couple of points. Because right now, a bill has been passed just within the last few weeks in the Alabama legislature to deal with the backlash. Something like 70 to 80% of the people in this country are in favor of in vitro fertilization techniques to help couples who want to have their own children and for whatever reason cannot. This is overwhelmingly popular. And that's not just a split where it's almost all Democrats and some Republicans. It's overwhelmingly popular among Democrats, Republicans, and independents. And I think anybody who knows anything about politics has looked at this and recognized the problem. And therefore, the Alabama legislature jumped in really quickly to try to make it seem like no matter what the Supreme Court in that state was doing, the state of Alabama was certainly not against in vitro fertilization, because immediately after that Supreme Court ruling, all of the clinics providing services in Alabama for in vitro fertilization stopped doing business, because any mistake, any incident could be deemed a murder. I would even say that if you interpret what Alabama's Supreme Court has done accurately, the process of implantation, so common today, 4, 5, 6 eggs implanted, because the odds are that you need, the statistics say that you need to implant that many if you hope to have one successful embryonic implantation. And when you blur what, you know, the Old Testament has always said about when life begins, that concept of first breath, and you even take it to the extreme that a fertilized egg that doesn't implant in its mother is some sort of a fully functioning person with equal rights, it means that every woman who ends up having a period that stops the implantation of a child into her uterine wall has committed some kind of, you know, killing, is in and of itself obviously outrageous. The question that this Walk the Earth episode looks at is, do we really believe that frozen embryos are people with equal personhood and therefore equal rights to other children? And I think the answer is not only obviously we don't believe that, but if you did believe it, and if you acted like you believed it, then you would be perhaps some kind of monster in the eyes of most of society. I would even say that the bill that's passed in Alabama's legislature, that the governor, I think, did sign last month, doesn't get the job done. This narrowly tailored bill is designed to protect doctors and clinics and other healthcare personnel who provide IVF treatment and services by offering such workers criminal and civil immunity, quote unquote. This is me quoting from an NBC News article written by Adam Edelman and published on March 6, 2024. This concept of immunity is a little bit, well, it's a little bit tenuous. The new law will provide, quote, provide civil and criminal immunity for death and damage to an embryo to any individual or entity when providing or receiving services related to in vitro fertilization, unquote. It says that, quote, no action, suit, or criminal prosecution for the damage or death to an embryo shall be brought or maintained against any individual or entity when providing or receiving services related to in vitro fertilization. I won't go into the article. The article itself can be found at nbcnews.com/alabama-lawmakers-IVF-protection-bill-vote-RCNA-141710. Again, it goes into more detail about why people who provide IVF services in the state of Alabama has still have some reason to be concerned, and only maybe 2 of 3 clinics have resumed normal service as a result of this bill being signed into law, because it doesn't close the actual loophole of whether or not what's happening inside these clinics, and what's happening to the tune of something like, well, more than 500,000, you know, frozen embryos across the country, is in fact some form of kidnapping and imprisonment. So that was one of the points that I wanted to nail home here, is that the legislature in Alabama has basically said, yes, we either don't disagree with the Supreme Court, but we're not going to disagree with the Alabama Supreme Court. We're going to let lie unchallenged the notion that frozen, non-implanted, not independently viable embryos are persons. They are people in the state of Alabama with rights equal to every other person in the state of Alabama. We're not going to challenge that. We're just going to say that if those persons are part of the in vitro fertilization process, then you cannot be prosecuted for accidentally killing them. You cannot be sued for wrongful death in their case. They've tried to insulate the in vitro fertilization process, but in the process of doing so, what they've said as a legislature is, yes, these are people in the state of Alabama, but these are people who can be killed with impunity. These are people in the state of Alabama who, because they're persons, can be held without due process forever in a state of confinement with no visitation because they have been essentially kidnapped through this process we call IVF and held against their will in some sort of a storage unit or storage vat, and that there is nothing, no law, no anything else, can force those people to be freed, because the short answer is freeing those people immediately kills them. In order to free them, they have to be implanted into a woman who will carry a child to a full-term birth. Now, where do you manage the rights here? Does a frozen embryo as a fully functioning person with a right not to be kidnapped and incarcerated against their will, if their will could even be discerned, have the right against a normal, healthy woman, maybe a late teenage girl who's technically an adult but still a young girl? Can this young girl be forced to carry one of those embryos that maybe she has no biological relationship to term because she is the only way that that frozen embryo can leave its incarcerated state of personhood and become as free as a fully innocent person who does not deserve to be incarcerated deserves to be? Or does the right of the, in this case, hypothetical 19-year-old girl step in and say, no, it's my body. I shouldn't be forced against my will to give birth to a frozen embryo just because that frozen embryo happens to be a person? These are the problems that Alabama has sort of shined a light on. There's an old saying, I think it's a public relations concept, that says, don't say or do anything that you wouldn't want in the morning paper. If you would be embarrassed by the magnification and publication of your actions, if the things you've done would be a problem for you if they were suddenly put on display, or if naive concepts once challenged, maybe even accidentally by an Alabama Supreme Court ruling, suddenly making it clear that your assumptions about personhood and embryos, if applied to IVF, would not only shut down IVF as a service available to any family anywhere in the country or anywhere in the jurisdiction of that court, but would actually raise questions that this court is still too naive to examine themselves, and that the Alabama legislature doesn't seem to recognize as such a travesty in their approach, that they have basically opened a license to kill with impunity for certain persons in the state of Alabama, separately and differently from other persons. And again, the state of Alabama, viewing two citizens differently based on factors like their religious beliefs or the color of their skin, perhaps even their age, this is not unusual for a lot of states in this country, including perhaps the state of Alabama. But in this case, the difference being made could potentially be an age distinction. Maybe it's more ageism, so it fits into the paradigm I've already sort of drawn by including age. And they're basically saying, no, if you're a frozen embryo in a vat in an IVF clinic, then killing you's not necessarily great, not necessarily what we want, but it's okay. Whereas we wouldn't say, hey, if you're a kid in this classroom, but you're young enough, if you're a kindergartner instead of like a fifth or sixth grader, well, then it's okay. You're young enough. It's okay. It's a product of not taking seriously what it means to confer upon fertilized eggs 100% full personhood. Unwittingly, perhaps, the Supreme Court in Alabama has exposed it, and the Alabama legislature, perhaps slapping themselves on the back and shaking each other's hands, feeling like they did something to solve it, didn't solve it. They only made it worse. My question stands, and it's the question Walk the Earth is facing today. If you really believe that a frozen embryo is the same as a child, and you were in a situation where it was necessary to save the frozen embryo or the child, but you couldn't save both, if one of them had to die in a fiery building collapse or whatever, would you kill this 6, 7, 8-year-old kid? Would you shove them back into the burning building to make sure they didn't interfere in any way with your effort to save the frozen embryo? And if your answer to that question is yes, is this what the Alabama legislature had in mind? Is this what the Alabama Supreme Court had in mind? Is this what the pro-life movement has in mind? And if so, this is just the first question. We need to be asking a lot more. Thanks for listening. Whether you would let a dozen people die to save 1,000 frozen embryos.
What's she gonna do then?
Well, that's what I've been sitting here contemplating. First, I'm gonna deliver this case to Marcellus. Then, basically, I'm just gonna walk the earth.
What you mean, walk the earth?
You know, like Kane in Kung Fu. Walk from place to place, meet people, get in adventures.
And how long do you intend to walk the earth?
Till God puts me where he wants me to be.
And what if you don't do that?
If it takes forever, then I'll walk forever.
Welcome to Walk the Earth. I'm Greg, and I realize that this is probably a political-sounding question, maybe the most politically-oriented question in the history of the Walk the Earth podcast. But then again, Walk the Earth is a spinoff of Inappropriate Conversations, and I assure you, I've dealt with more or less the political side of this kind of question in greater detail previously on Inappropriate Conversations. Right up front, I'll drop a couple of references. Then I want to get to a Bible verse, because I don't want to answer this question from a political perspective. I want to view it more as a moral difficulty and lead us through the path of considering a thought experiment. Not my own thought experiment, by the way, and I'll give credit when credit's due at the appropriate time. But first, anyone who's come to Walk the Earth noticing this question and looking for more of a legal or political exploration of it, well, you're going to find that somewhere else. It's the same feed at www.inappropriateconversations.org, but that perspective is more the Inappropriate Conversations podcast approach. This is Walk the Earth, and Walk the Earth asks questions about the way we do church as Christians. It's going to be more of a Christian, spiritual, moral conundrum approach. So let me point you to a couple of previous Inappropriate Conversations for those who would prefer to hear maybe more of an argumentative answer. Because I'm really just trying to ask a big question in this particular Walk the Earth. But if you go back to the election year of 2012, November 21st, 2012, as a matter of fact, Inappropriate Conversations number 105 at that point was called Press Coverage, and it was looking at the media in particular. But the episode turned out to be about twice as long as what at the time was a normal Inappropriate Conversations podcast. I decided to call a bluff from people who had claimed that there was some sort of unbalanced scale, uneven approach to the way the media in particular questions the moral consistency, for want of a better word, of pro-life political candidates. After the different drummer in that particular episode, I kind of went in this direction. Many partisan conservatives believe that the media never asked hard questions of pro-choice candidates during the debates and on the campaign trail. This was in 2012, but I'm sure it applies before and since. It isn't because those questions are difficult to answer. And the second half of this particular podcast, back in 2012, I took an off-the-cuff set of questions and answered them. But really, that was sort of an incomplete, impromptu approach, because answers to questions related to abortion had been covered by me pretty early on, a year and a half earlier, in fact, in June of 2011. Probably the Inappropriate Conversations shows that were released the closest together for two different podcasts, number 59 and number 60, within 2 days or 3 days of each other back in June of 2011. It was simply called 10 Areas of Agreement About Abortion, Part 1 and Part 2. And I might be treading some familiar ground here, but only just barely. Because what I intend to do, instead of introducing the same arguments that have been made on Inappropriate Conversations, and doing it from a Walk the Earth perspective, my intent instead is to go to places that I never really went, or never fully went, back then. I'd mentioned an Inappropriate Conversations podcast almost a year ago, thinking about the loss of my mother, who died last year. And one of the gifts, one of the things that I was inheriting, I guess, for want of a better word, that I really was thrilled to see, because I'd actually had it on my list of things to go find for quite some time, was a particular translation of the Bible, a particularly good word-for-word translation of the Bible. I've always heard it referred to as the New American Standard Bible, NASB 1971. But the version I've got from my mom, that was given to my father from somebody that he knew in a Bible study class back in January of 1981. So it's been in the family for quite some time, but it's called just the New American Bible, translated from the original languages with critical use of all ancient sources by members of the Catholic Biblical Association of America, and sponsored by the Bishop's Committee of the Confraternity of Christian Doctrine, and published by the Catholic Press originally in 1970. But as I mentioned, it's called here NAB 1971. And this still stands, in my opinion, as one of the better word-for-word translations of the Bible. Now, to compare this to other biblical translations like the New International Version or the Good News Bible, for that matter, those are more idea-for-idea translations, trying to represent verse to verse or section of verses to section of verses as accurately as possible what the original language, whether that be Hebrew or Greek or Aramaic, was trying to convey. But this effort in the New American Bible was to try to get that even closer in and make sure that even the ideas that were being translated into another language were, you know, done with a great deal of fidelity to the actual words being used. So a word-for-word translation. And even as late as 1993, 1994, this stood as the NAB or NASB translation. In 1995, though, a new version, an updated version, was released. This was not a version updated because additional ancient sources had been found, or a new language interpretation had been done through some sort of study. It was simply an effort to update the text to more accurately reflect what the Catholic Association of Bishops believed was true at the time. In other words, if you look at a 1995 or later version of this same translation of the Bible, you're going to find passages that have been changed. And again, changed not because we've discovered another set of, well, Dead Sea Scrolls or anything of that nature. Simply changed because the politics in the United States of America shifted as well. Case in point, Exodus chapter 21, verses 22 and 23. When men have a fight and hurt a pregnant woman so that she suffers a miscarriage, but no further injury, the guilty one shall be fined as much as the woman's husband demands of him, and he shall pay in the presence of the judges. But if injury ensues, you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. This is an entire section of Exodus 21 dealing with how to handle the law from a Torah perspective when it comes to personal injury. I personally do not know any Jewish people who feel that this particular reading of those two verses is in any way a mistranslation. And in fact, it's very hard to find a translation of the Bible that dates before, say, the Reagan administration that had any different translation of this particular passage. The other thing that's interesting is that it's covering this entire realm of what to do when someone does great bodily harm or takes a life. Let me quickly put it in context by reading maybe verses 18 through 27. It will, of course, repeat these two verses again, but I feel the repetition is worth it because these are a couple of the verses of the Bible, at least this particular translation of the Bible, which have been doctored. And that doctoring has influenced subsequent translations as well, unfortunately. Back to Exodus 21 for just a moment. When men quarrel and one strikes another with a stone or a fist, not mortally, but enough to put him in bed, the one who struck the blow shall be acquitted, provided the other can get up and walk around with the help of his staff. Still, he must compensate him for the enforced idleness and provide for his complete cure. When a man strikes his male or female slave with a rod so hard that the slave dies under his hand, he shall be punished. If, however, the slave survives for a day or two, he is not to be punished, since the slave is his own property. When men have a fight and hurt a pregnant woman so that she suffers a miscarriage, but no further injury, the guilty one shall be fined as much as the woman's husband demands of him, and he shall pay in the presence of the judges. But if injury ensues, you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot, burn for burn, wound for wound, stripe for stripe. When a man strikes his male or female slave in the eye and destroys the use of the eye, he shall let the slave go free in compensation for the eye. If he knocks out a tooth of his male or female slave, he shall let the slave go free in compensation for the tooth. This is the context of an original word-for-word translation of Exodus chapter 21, and in particular verses 22 and 23 from New American Standard Bible, 1971. I bring it up because it's factually true that from the perspective of the Torah, the miscarriage, which is the death of a child being born, in this case, born through the collateral damage of a pregnant woman being caught in the midst of two people fighting, that death does not carry the life for life. It doesn't even really carry the same sort of consequences, the death of the child, that maybe even injuring a slave would. That if you willfully and violently injured your slave, you might have to set that slave free back in ancient times. But if you strike a pregnant woman and do her no lasting damage other than the miscarriage, well, you're going to have to agree on what fine to pay the husband for the loss of that child. And that's kind of it. It certainly undermines any notion that biblically life begins at conception. Unless, of course, you come along 24 years later and just decide you're going to rewrite all those verses. Which leads me to the question that we want to deal with today. How do we then, if it isn't as cut and dried as we've been told to be by politically active Christians, how do we, from a spiritual perspective, understand where we stand on this question of conception, whether life begins there, or does life begin at birth, or some point of viability somewhere in between? At what point have you crossed that line? Because to me, that probably can only be well understood or ascertained by doing a thought experiment. Now, as I get into this, I'm going to introduce the concepts from another writer and try to address the question a little bit from my own perspective that way. But the first thing you're going to hear from anybody who would rather not deal with this question or finds themselves on the opposite side of what they tell themselves they think the right answer is a whole lot of reasons why hypotheticals are somehow wrong. And I would simply point those folks to the New Testament and ask them to cast themselves in the story told in Luke's gospel when Jesus is talking about the parable of the Good Samaritan. Are you going to be the one in the crowd when you suddenly realize that Jesus is casting the generally despised Samaritan people in a protagonist or even hero role in that story? Are you going to be the one in the crowd saying, well, hey, that's just a hypothetical, and hypotheticals are a waste of time, and we shouldn't be asked to consider these things, and what does that crazy rabbi think he's doing? No, I think that when a thought experiment is conducted, even if it isn't particularly fruitful, or even if you really can't get your head around it, I think the answer there reveals a lot about what we think and what we believe. An unwillingness to consider an answer reveals a lot about what we think and what we believe. And frankly, I would be very suspicious of anybody who claims to be thoughtful and cannot deal with even the slightest, most mildly challenging abstract thought. Because that's what we're talking about. An abstract question. The question, again, for this particular walk the earth, is whether you would let a dozen people die to save 1,000 frozen embryos. This question, and the way I want to consider it, was inspired, in many ways, by something I saw on Twitter. It's not by a person I follow on Twitter, but nevertheless, I felt strongly enough about it that I kind of saved the link for use in this particular episode of Walk the Earth. Patrick S. Tomlinson, again, somebody I don't know personally, somebody I don't follow on social media, but I did, for whatever reason, stumble across this particular question. Whenever abortion comes up, I have a question I've been asking for 10 years now of the Life Begins at Conception crowd. In 10 years, no one has ever answered it honestly. It's a simple scenario with two outcomes. No one ever wants to pick one because the correct answer destroys their argument. And there is a correct answer, which is why the pro-life crowd hates this question. Here it is, says Tomlinson. You're in a fertility clinic. Why is it important? The fire alarm goes off. You run for the exit. And as you run down this hallway, you hear a child screaming from behind a door. You throw open the door and find a 5-year-old child crying for help. There in one corner of the room, and in the other corner, you spot a frozen container labeled 1,000 viable human embryos. The smoke is rising. You start to choke. You know you can grab one or the other, but not both, before you succumb to smoke inhalation and die, saving no one. Do you A, save the child, or B, save the 1,000 frozen embryos? There is no C. C means you all die. In a decade of arguing with anti-abortion people about the definition of human life, I have never gotten a single straight A or B answer to this question, and I never will. They will never answer honestly because we all instinctively understand that the right answer is A. A human child is worth more than 1,000 embryos, or 10,000, or 1,000,000, because they are not the same, not morally, not ethically, not biologically. This question absolutely eviscerates their arguments, and their refusal to answer confirms that they know it to be true. No one, anywhere, actually believes that an embryo is equivalent to a child. That person does not exist. They are lying to you. They are lying to you to try to evoke an emotional response, a paternal response, using false equivalency. No one believes life begins at conception. No one believes embryos are babies or children. Those who claim to are trying to manipulate you so they can control women. Don't let them. Use this question to call them out. Reveal them for what they are. Demand they answer your question, and when they don't, slap that big old scarlet P of the patriarchy on them. The end. These are the words of Patrick S. Tomlinson. And I'm going to keep the majority of his scenario for the way I want to consider it, because I agree with him. The details, why you're in a fertility clinic, for example, yeah, they're not really all that important. So what if really what it was there had been some sort of collapse in the building, that this fire had been created by some sort of earthquake or some other, unsound engineering problem, where you're convinced that not only could you succumb to smoke inhalation and either choke to death or burn to death, but maybe the whole building is going to come down on you. And in the same way, now maybe it's more than 1,000 frozen embryos. Maybe that vat is at least 1,000 or 10,000 or 500,000 or some other number like that, because if frozen embryos don't inherently take up that much space necessarily, you could see how a strong, able-bodied person could carry something containing thousands of fully functioning human lives because of, you get the idea. But what if what it was you had enough time to lift this vat and carry it out before the smoke got you, or you had enough time to remove wreckage and debris from a door that was trapping a dozen people inside a room? Whatever the scenario, if it comes down to one child versus 1,000 embryos, maybe that's a hard decision for some. I've read responses online to this particular question that were posed back to Tomlinson. But what if it was a dozen? What if it was 100? If the pro-life point of view, their political point of view, to be fair, is true, then 1,000 frozen embryos is always going to be 1,000 times more valuable than that frightened and potentially unconscious 7, 8, 9-year-old kid, right? Or 10 times or 100 times more valuable than a dozen people trapped behind debris in some sort of a room. And I think, as I've always considered questions like this and tried to come away with an answer, anybody who says this is a hard question needs to wrestle with the fact that this is actually the easy version, because it gets a lot more difficult if you start saying, well, hey, if you actually would be, because your politics are so central to your life and are more important to you than your values or even your moral compass in some cases, that you might be willing to say, well, no, I would sacrifice that one child because I'm just, quote unquote, that pro-life. Well, what if it was your child? And then what does it say about you if you'd let 1,000 people die a horrific, you know, fiery death with a building collapsing on them to save one child? But the difference is you wouldn't save anybody else's. You might just save your own. This scenario gets more and more difficult the more detail you pour behind it. So I tried to make it a little bit more simple and keeping the situation where you're in this building, you don't know anybody, but you've identified this situation. You have a chance to be a hero. And are you going to be a hero to 1,000 frozen embryos, or are you going to be a hero to a person or a dozen people who are trapped in a building and inevitably going to die? And if you try to say both, then you all go. I think that's a fair part of the thought experiment. Because it really isn't that much of a... it's more of a thought experiment with regards to cowardice if you're not in any jeopardy yourself. If the building has not been compromised, there's just a fire, and you've got some sort of gas mask and other sort of fire protection gear. You're a fireman, or something along those lines. But no, this is boiled down to being an ordinary average person and asking yourself as an ordinary average person whether the cries of a young child or a teenager even, is that going to be more of a priority for you if you've only got the ability to save one? If you only have one more trip out of this building before it's too late, or are you going to let that person die? Maybe even kick that person out of your way as they try to cling to you and hopefully climb on top and ride you to safety somehow, because it's very important that you forcefully remove this person and leave them to their fate in order to save that container of frozen embryos. I've actually asked the question a different way before, because I would make the argument that if you were hardcore pro-life and were actually inclined to, you know, maybe even do physical violence to a child or a teenager or even an adult who was trying to get you to rescue them at the expense of these embryos, that you might be, in your own mind, heroic on two different levels. Because on one level, there's just a numbers game here, right? If all of these lives are equal, and if we really believe they're equal, and if we honestly engage in the thought experiment and come back with the answer that they are equal, well, first, I'm going to be a little bit concerned about going on any sort of potentially dangerous expedition with you as my right-hand man. You know, no offense, but I think I would be a little bit worried that if we were climbing up a mountain and there was some sort of avalanche, that trying to decide whether to save me or save a nest full of bird eggs, you might go with the nest full of bird eggs. It's just a numbers game. There's more birds there, right? But the other reason that you might arguably view yourself as heroic for choosing to save the 1,000 frozen embryos in this situation as presented is because those aren't just, in your mind, fully functioning human beings with equal rights to everybody, especially some future mother within whom they might be implanted to see if some of them are born. But they're actually in many ways captives, and captives with almost no hope of being set free, with almost no hope of due process, because they're stuck in sort of a, again, frozen embryonic state. They're essentially against any will they may have as embryos, which I realize is in and of itself a thought experiment to consider that idea. But beyond any will they may have as embryos, they are essentially jailed. They are entombed, for want of a better word, with, again, no due process ever getting them out of there. And in many cases, the couple who are responsible for creating that embryo may have really, really good, sincere emotional reasons for never wanting those embryos to be implanted into the womb of a potentially expected mother. And even if an in vitro procedure were performed and, you know, a half dozen of them were implanted into the womb, the odds are very, very high that most of them are going to die, that their equal right to life has been consigned to essentially being farmed out as a numbers game, that maybe one of them will actually be born and become a baby that we can then ignore in a situation like this because 1,000 embryos or 999 more embryos than one child, and the child may have to be sacrificed to save those embryos, even though those embryos may, even once removed from the building, remain in the custody of the fertility clinic or the people who, again, as a couple, created those embryos, they may actually remain in their permanent imprisoned state forever, never to be implanted and never to be in any way brought to a comfortable end to whatever your definition of life may be. In other words, there is a level where the belief in a hardcore perspective from the pro-life movement about life beginning at conception and truly taking that to its logical end puts you in sort of a weird spot where you're kind of comfortable with a certain form of slavery, a certain form of human trafficking, if you will, where until these, you know, fully human things, these people, quote unquote, are needed by two other people, then they will remain sort of permanently in prison. So somebody who weighs the two options and says, you know what, I'm going to have to let this child or this, you know, teenager die because I've got to save the frozen embryos, again, they might tell themselves that, well, not only am I saving more quote-unquote people in one grand heroic gesture, but the people that I'm saving have been wrongfully imprisoned for, you know, potentially years, potentially decades, potentially forever. And yet, I've yet to meet anybody who consider themselves pro-life, who think that life begins at conception, who would really struggle with these ideas that in this particular fire, those embryos are going to perish, who would acknowledge the fact that there's something fundamentally morally wrong with what led them to be cryogenically frozen and stored in this manner in the first place. But that's not really the question today. That's, again, slightly more of a confrontational, inappropriate conversations piece of consideration. But for me, as I think it through, I cannot imagine myself leaving somebody with agency, somebody who is a person who's been born, who is functioning, who either is still a minor in the custody of parents who would have a real issue with me if they felt like I had made the choice and decided that their child simply had to die today because there were frozen embryos that needed to be saved. You know, for example, or my child, where I was making this decision and I decided, you know, I'm going to look my wife in the eye and say, yes, I had to let our child die because, well, I had 1,000 other, quote, people, unquote, to save. I don't know that that wouldn't be the end of my marriage. It might very well be the end of my life, which means that I know for a fact I'm married to somebody who feels strongly enough about saving the child, whether our child or not, that it could be a deal breaker to make the decision in any other way. But I guess when I look at it, I'm wondering, well, why wouldn't it be a deal breaker? And I'm not here to speak from a, you know, inappropriate conversations, political perspective, siding with Tomlinson in this case that, you know, yeah, you can't really find somebody honest enough to even answer this question if they've got that sort of, you know, hardcore pro-life perspective. But remember the Bible verse that I shared today, which basically says, hey, even if you accidentally hit a pregnant woman and hit her so hard that it causes her to miscarry, and that miscarriage inevitably back in those days is going to lead to the death of the child, that there is no life-for-life punishment. There's not even a limb-for-limb or a tooth-for-tooth punishment there. It's figure out what you got to pay the husband of that woman's baby to make the problem go away. And I've heard arguments, justifications for subsequent translations of this, the NIV translation, for example, people who've defended that by saying that, well, maybe the verse just means instead of miscarry, maybe it means that she's not carrying the baby in her womb anymore, but it magically came out and survived because my Bible would never ignore the death of a child because an unborn child is a human life. It is, fully human from the point of conception. It doesn't appear to be what the original text had to say. In fact, again, the predominant view of people for whom the books were written, the Jewish point of view, is that that first breath, that initial breath of a child outside the womb, that is the breath of life. That's a very different idea than saying that in an embryonic state, in in an amniotic sac, a fluid breathing entity is a human with the breath of life inside it. It's just a very different idea. Now, in an Inappropriate Conversations perspective, I would explore other concepts. Bodily autonomy, for example. Or the idea that somebody has a right to defend themselves, and therefore where the life of the mother is in any way in peril, either due to medical issues with the pregnancy itself, or due to the possibility that an outraged parent or outraged spouse may react violently and harm the woman in the light of the pregnancy, that there are, you could certainly understand or excuse why a woman might take deadly force into her own hands to protect her own life. I'm not going to go there. Here, the life choice I'm interested in is that if we are serious about equivocating as quote-unquote fully human, two very different ideas, we might come up with a very different answer to this question. We might say that if there was no vat of embryos here involved at all, that I had the opportunity to save a very young teenager or a child even, cowering in the corner of a room of a burning building, but I also had the ability to clear the debris out of a different part of the building and rescue a dozen people. Well, do you rescue the dozen? Do you rescue the child? I mean, these questions are inherently difficult when you're dealing with two, people with agency. But when you're dealing with imprisoned, frozen embryos, embryos that may never become a child, may never get implanted into a uterus and have that sort of 50-50 at best chance of becoming a child, or even having the ownership of that particular property belonging to a couple who's decided that those particular embryos will never be implanted and never become a child. That's a different situation altogether. And the fact that it makes us uncomfortable, if it does not relieve us of the obligation of conducting the thought experiment. The idea behind thought experiments, the idea behind parables, even the short and simple ones like considering the lilies of the field or a pearl of great price. Even the very short, quick ones are asking us to say, stop thinking about yourself for a moment. Put yourself in the shoes of whatever situation is being presented to you, because when it's over, you can always flee back to the comfort of yourself and hopefully take with you whatever you've learned. Because there's something in an honest response to a question like this, which reveals a lot about our morality, that someone may make what I would consider a political decision to construct some argument for why saving thousands of frozen embryos is definitely the way to go. But I also think that thought, that said, put in this Sophie's Choice situation, I'm definitely going to let the frightened child cowering in the corner die. I might even punch or kick or otherwise shoo that kid away because I only have enough strength and energy and air in my lungs to save the vat, to save the frozen embryos. It tells us things about ourselves that I think Tomlinson is right to suggest that some people would say or do anything to avoid answering the question because they don't want to live with the mental consequences of it as it lingers. I don't think thought experiments are easy. I don't go into this lightly. I don't do it often for a reason, because I think that there is a lot to wrestle with long after the actual answer has been considered or given or avoided. I'm just thinking that for this one, I don't find it as hard as other people do. And maybe it's because I've answered more difficult and challenging thought experiments over the years, or maybe it's because I don't come in with a firmly entrenched political position. It's worth considering. If and as you are led, please join me in prayer. Merciful God, many of us believe that it is surely your grace that keeps us from having to face decisions like this on an everyday basis. But Lord, give us the moral character, the strength, the ethical integrity to consider honestly questions like this from time to time so we would have insight into what we might do if faced with, particular, unwelcome, unfortunate, calamitous choices. I do not wish this so-called devil's bargain on anyone. It is not something that I take lightly and not something that I ask anyone to consider lightly. But Lord, you challenged us in your walk on this earth. Very few examples of you speaking to a large crowd didn't leave the crowd befuddled and wondering, what am I supposed to do with that? So continue to show your mercy upon us as we know that we are going to fail in one manner or another. when faced with situations like this, either hypothetically or in reality. In some ways, God, it helps me remember that it is your mercy at the end of the day that I'm relying upon, no matter which way I face the choices that I confront. In your holy name I pray. Amen.
What happened this morning, man, I agree, it was peculiar. But water into wine,
All shapes and sizes, Vincent.
You shouldn't talk to me that way, man.
If my answers frighten you, Vincent, then you should cease asking scary questions.
This show is part of the Pride 48 Network. Find more shows over at pride48.com.